I'm not sure that every civilization, or even most civilizations, have taken the norm or injunction to achieve self-knowledge as being among the most important ones. That I would say is something more like it comes and goes. So it did have a cachet in Greece of 300, 400 BC. Whether it had anything like a similar cachet 200 years later, and whether it was something that had cultural importance in at the heyday of Roman civilization is another question. Of course, some philosophers and others would have enjoined people to engage in a search for self-knowledge, self-understanding. Others, perhaps not so much. And likewise, think about the Middle Ages. There is a case in which we don't get a whole lot of emphasis on knowing the self, rather we want to know God. And it was only really until Descartes came back on the scene in centuries later that we began to get more of a focus on introspection and understanding ourselves by looking within and reasoning on.
You point that as a turning point in Western philosophy.
Right. Exactly. So I think that's so a couple things then. One, it's for various reasons, cultural, political, economic, ideological, the norm of self-knowledge has kind of come and gone with the tides in various ways throughout human Western history. At least I don't feel as much special knowledge, expertise about non-Western histories to be able to say anything about that with much confidence, but at least what little bit I've been able to dabble in non-Western traditions has not shown me a great deal of interest in that. Some Buddhist traditions would be a counterexample, would be an exception to that. Even if we are constantly enjoined, even if we had been continuously enjoined to achieve self-knowledge for the 2,300 years since the time Socrates spoke and so forth, just as Freud said about civilization, saying civilization is constantly being created anew, that is, everybody who's born has to work their way up into being a civilized being, and it's a new project with every new baby, so too the project of achieving self-knowledge is a challenge for every single new member of our species, and no one can be given it at birth. It's an achievement. It's not something you get for free. So continuing to beat that drum, continuing to remind people of the importance of that, is something that I think we'll always be doing. I don't think there's ever going to be a point. I'm doubtful that there will ever be a point at which we can all say, yep, we're good on that. We've got that covered. We've got self-knowledge down. That's something that's just a challenge with everybody, for each of us, every time somebody's born. And I would also say, given the sort of ambient, environmental, as well as processes that were just or sort of predilections that we're born with as part of our probably cognitive, maybe even genetic nature, there are probably pressures that push against self-knowledge as well. So in the book I talk about the cognitive immune system, which makes us tend to spin things in our own favor. When something goes bad, there's a certain part of us that generally and on the whole, hopefully within bounds, tends to try to see that glass as half full rather than half empty. That's probably a good way of getting yourself up off the floor after you've been knocked down.
As you're going about daily life and working and trying to earn a living and raising a family and whatever else you're doing, thinking ahead as the financial retirement planners would have you think about, well, should you supposed to know yourself well enough to know what your needs are going to be then and maybe want to be surfing at the end or create art or music when you have all of your time to use.
That's
so at what point should that thought of getting to know yourself better begin? It can't begin too early because you haven't developed yet as to what your interest is.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't encourage a 9-year-old to engage in a whole lot of self-scrutiny, but I would say in some ways, even when you're young, some of those indirect, especially self-distancing types of activities can actually be of value. So imagine a 9-year-old gets in a fight on the playground with another kid, a teacher asking them, given what you said to that other kid, the thing that provoked the fight, if you had had someone say that to you, how would you feel? That's a little inkling of self-knowledge, or at least a solicitation of it right there. So I would say, for me, if not in the form of introspection, but in the form of developing empathetic skills, which I think are themselves a part of self-knowledge because they allow me to see myself from another's through another's eyes, that can't begin too early as far as I'm concerned. And secondly, I'd also say, you know, in my experience, lots of people who are in or near retirement have this idea that, okay, they're just going to stop working and they're going to be really happy because they're going to relax, take it easy and so forth. And I find that again and again, that tends to crash and burn because so many people find so much fulfillment, rightly so, out of their work. And so I would urge people who are my age, I consider myself early middle age, or older, would do well to think about what is it that gives them satisfaction. And granted, we spend a lot of time, you know, spitting nails and thinking about the various challenges that our jobs and so forth present to us. But in some ways, that constant grumbling or frequent grumbling, the kind of hair pulling and stress and so forth, that might be part of what makes life fulfilling.
Well, let me drill down even further. Mm-hmm. We're on a college campus with 20,000 yeah. undergraduates
right.
who are between the ages of 17 and probably 22.
Right.
They're trying to learn more about themselves through what they're studying, and they're making decisions on mm-hmm. what they think they may want to do
yeah.
for the rest of their life.
Right.
They're taking classes like philosophy yeah. and other subjects which force them to think about these things.
Mm-hmm. Attempt to get them to think about these things.
These things. Is this an optimal time
sure.
in life to do that, because you learn how to think a little yeah. bit better and more yeah. clearly when you're going through these processes
yeah.
here?
For many students, it's an optimal time. There's certainly plenty of students I've encountered for whom this isn't, they shouldn't be in college. This is not the place for them to do that. Or maybe they should be in college, but they're perfectly happy getting a purely technical degree and working in a technical job that does not require the sorts of things that humanistic liberal arts types of education try to cultivate. I consider one component of a liberal arts education to be that of the cultivation of self-knowledge. So one philosopher of education once said that a college degree, essentially, university education, is essentially the sustained cultivation of the self. So learning a lot of stuff is important, but in some ways that's just filling. What matters is the cultivation of the self, and that includes, you know, if you want to cultivate yourself, you have to have some ideas to how you want it to grow, how you want it to develop, which requires some inkling of what you think you are and what you think you can be. And those are things that students can only do by sort of trying things and seeing what happens. And so for me, it's not as if I have the idea that a freshman should come to college and plan in a sort of rigorous and lockstep way to learn about themselves and to cultivate themselves and to bring themselves into fruition as a fully formed adult upon graduation at age 22 or 23. Rather, there's much more messiness, much more inherent kind of try things, doesn't work, throw it aside, try something else. Not all those who wander, not exactly, as it should be, not all those who wander are lost. So I'm all in favor of that. But in spite of all that messiness and ambient kind of chaos, I would also say, in the midst of that, there is potential for learning about yourself, taking note of, that didn't go well, what can I learn from that? That was really cool, I really enjoyed that, I'd like to build on that experience and do more of it. Those are all good. Those are all ways of both learning about yourself and, at the same time, constructing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things can go hand in hand. So I decided, I like this, I'm going to do more of it, and so doing, I'm going to build up skills, build up levels of appreciation, and semi-expertise of the sorts that you can find among undergraduate students, maybe not full expertise, but semi, that allow them to take a next step and say, I'm now at this intermediate level, I'm still enjoying it, I'm still finding it satisfying, I'm going to build up more on that. So it's a cumulative and developing process. But the general point is just that, first of all, self-knowledge, self-realization, and self-scrutiny can happen, albeit in an often messy and unpredictable way for undergraduates. But I would also suggest that it's illusory to think that we should finish at age 22 and then button up our, you know, put on our ties or dresses and high heels and go to work and stop doing that other stuff. I think that I would urge that the process of acquiring knowledge about yourself, understanding yourself, is a lifelong task.
There's the philosophy that you should try to learn something new every day.
Mm.
And a lot of people who go through this process in college
mm-hmm.
begin to understand
right.
that that's what they should do,
right.
while others say, okay, I know that, I'm done.
I'm done.
I can go on.
Exactly.
Which also takes me back to, again, the foundation
mm-hmm.
of the beginning of the book about Socrates' defense of himself,
mm-hmm.
of being accused of corrupting youth
yeah.
by teaching them.
Yeah.
And basically he's saying, you know, I know what I don't know, and that's why I ask questions.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And that's a very important insight on his part, and something that I would be inclined to yell from the rooftops, in the sense that one big barrier to achieving anything in the direction of self-knowledge is hubris, thinking that we do know, and often confusing our confidence in our opinions with thinking that I'm confident in it, that somehow my degree of confidence is itself an indication, a signal of my degree of correctness. So we often, you know, say, feel sure, and therefore take that surety, that certainty itself, to be, in a way, a kind of independent source of evidence of the truth of what we think. And Socrates is right to say that's a mistake, that's a cognitive error, that's fallacious reasoning. We should ask ourselves, do I know what I take myself to know? And it seems to me the beginning of wisdom of any kind, including wisdom about ourselves, is acknowledgement of our the infirmity of our knowledge, the paucity of it, the fact that a lot of opinions that we have are things that might just be opinions. And it's always just astonishing to me the disparity between the confidence with which people express their opinions on the one hand and the ability that they have to back them up, especially those opinions that involve things that go beyond just whether they're hungry or prefer chocolate over vanilla. Those are things about which you can perhaps have pretty confident opinions. But when it comes to politics or things from science or history, human psychology and so forth, it's surprising to me just how gullible people are, not so much because they believe what other people say, so to speak, but rather they believe what they themselves say. They tend to just say, here's what I think, seems obvious to me, and I'm not willing to even consider skeptical objections and opposition. This is how it is.
But you also bring into to the fold, she describes the theory of adaptive unconscious, uh-huh. that you're observing and picking things up, although you don't realize it.
That's right.
At the time.
Right.
How much does that feed into people thinking that they know themselves better than they do and know more than they think they do?
Yeah, right. I think it's huge. I spent a chapter talking about classical psychoanalysis, right. A lot of time talking about Freud. It's a lot of fun to read. He's a great writer, wonderful rhetorician. But I argue that it's less controversial to say this than it would have been 20 years ago. But I argue that the Freudian legacy is a sort of broken one in the sense that while his work is incredibly interesting, he made a lot of very provocative and ingenious claims. Surprisingly few of them have been borne out with empirical evidence. And that left open experimental psychologists in the 70s and 80s primarily to begin to ask, well, how many of those Freudian claims about the unconscious can be established in a rigorous experimental way? And so the theory of the adaptive unconscious is an attempt to do that, to find out how much of the so-called unconscious mind that people like Freud posited is real and what is it like. And one of the main findings is that unconscious mind, insofar as it's real, we can be at least supporting experimentally, is not quite as bound up with, obsessed with sexuality and violence as the one that was posited by Freud and friends. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's still a very powerful system, and not necessarily a thing to be kept at bay in the way that psychoanalysis would have said. Right? According to Freud, a great deal of what's in the unconscious poses a constant threat to the well-functioning of civilized society, the smooth functioning of civilized society. Whereas for people like Tim Wilson, Gilbert, Ledoux, Paul Ekman, many others, we've got a view that says, in many ways, having an adaptive unconscious is a useful thing. It's a sort of outsourcing of lots of cognition because it allows us to process information, interpret it, and so forth, without having to consciously and painstakingly and deliberately calculate things. That's really hard. That's cognitively very demanding. Whereas, I mean, think about, for example, language. If you are fluent or knowledgeable in a language, when you see a sentence or hear a sentence, you understand it, even though it's a complex cognitive process, as my linguist friends over in the linguistics department would be quick to point out, it's a very complicated cognitive process. So I'm glad that my unconscious mind outsources my language processing, because that makes my life vastly easier. And if you think it's easy, then think about a language which you're trying to learn right now. Suppose you're trying to learn Hungarian. It's just in the first semester of Hungarian. Oh, now I've got a sentence of Hungarian in front of me. Think of how hard it is to interpret that thing. Where's the noun? Right? What do I do with that? It's incredibly difficult.
And so German will all nouns at the end.
Yeah, exactly. And so unless you're fluent at it or nearly so, it is a pull. And so it's really good in many ways that we have an adaptive unconscious. On the other hand, it tends to predispose us, for example, to things like prejudice. So the big discussion nowadays of so-called implicit bias has taught us that our exposure, not because we harbor consciously any racist or sexist or other bigoted attitudes. Nevertheless, the fact that we grew up watching Hollywood movies in which most protagonists, heroes were white or male or both. The fact that we have been inundated with advertising, which, again, you've got stereotypes that have been promulgated, has that experience by itself, even if I've never had a consciously bigoted, racist, sexist, whatever thought in my life, can still cause me to make choices that are biased, as someone hiring candidates for a job or interviewing people for a doctoral position or whatever. So that's a part of the sort of take-home message that the theory of the adaptive unconscious would make us want to take very seriously and be really generally worried about, because it can affect our choices in ways that we're not aware of.
So the individual who would know themselves well, what kind of person would that be?
I would say it's got a number of different parts. There's no one essential pot of gold at the end of the rainbow kind of thing that's there. One of them certainly involves acknowledging your limitations, owning your limitations. Those limitations can be cognitive, my lousy memory, my tendency to distort the information, my tendency to sugarcoat information that I get about myself, for example. You know, take a professor's experience of reading student evaluations. It's easy to forget the negative ones and easy to remember the positive ones. And so knowing that I tend to do that, if that's what I tend to do, allows me to take a second look and say, as painful as it might be, I better go look at some of the negative ones too. It'll hurt, but I better. So acknowledging my limitations. Am I overly critical? Do I tend to see the glasses overly half full or overly half empty? One of those things. Those are all limitations of an emotional kind that a person can be prone to. Self-knowledge certainly requires knowing if there are facts about me that are distinctive, I should take note of them and try to compensate for them when appropriate. So that's one thing. So knowing my tendencies to get into trouble, either cognitively or affectively, and then thinking about ways to counteract them is of value. And then also, perhaps more positively, learning about the things that I do find valuable. And one of the challenges there is knowing how to separate the things that I genuinely find valuable from the things that I think I find valuable because someone told me to, because of that, you know, Rolex commercial I just saw, or the car ad I just got had my eyes caught by, or something of the sort, right? So knowing how to separate the things that I value from the things that from the values that for example advertisers want to cultivate in me is a challenge, and advertisers are really, really clever and crafty about getting me to think I like stuff that I might not in fact have adequately done. So that's an aspect of it. And then I think I'd also say, again, I want to go back to empathy, knowing how to see things from another person's point of view is not guaranteed to, but I think often apt to allow me to see myself more effectively too. Because if I can, to some extent, put myself imaginatively into your shoes, then I might also have a chance of being able to see myself through your eyes, and that might get me to realize some things that would have been difficult, I don't want to say impossible, but difficult to have seen from just the first personal perspective.
Then what would someone gain in self-knowledge mm-hmm. by listening to someone appraising them and speaking to them about how well they knew them and doing what you just did, asking yourself those questions, but being told you are this way, you are that way. How does that dynamic help?
First of all, it can help, but it can also be shocking because the experiments have suggested that other people's assessment of an individual can often be very out of line with that person's self-assessment. And it's not clear that those other people's assessments are less accurate. In some cases, they're more accurate, as determined by relatively well-established objective psychological assessments. So I would say third personal assessments from other people can be both difficult to swallow, bitter medicine, and also extremely valuable. And because they're difficult to swallow, they're, I would suggest, taking them in small doses because it hurts. So, you know, at the end of a semester, I encourage my teaching assistants to read about course evaluations, but don't try to read them all at once. And maybe if you can get something out of it, try to take one suggestion from those course evaluations that you could go into the next semester with as a thing to work on your teaching.
How do you determine where to think first on this? Is it what's going on right now, or just being reflective as to where things were?
Well, I don't think either one has priority over the other. They're just appropriate for different questions. And I would say in the first step, let's distinguish them, because, for example, when philosophers know to talk about personal identity, I think they tend to mash them together. Are we talking about what it is to be a person at a moment, or are we talking about what it is for this, so to speak, time slice of a person to be the same individual as the time slice of a person that existed a week, a month, or even 10 years ago? Those are two separate questions that I think tend to get confused.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what I'm doing is just, let's keep them separate. It might be the case that a theory of one answers questions about the other. That'd be great, but we can't expect that from the get-go. So I want to separate them. And I would say, of course, a great deal of what we care about as in our status as persons is in the diachronic form. That is to say, how can I cultivate myself? How can I become the kind of person I want to be? Of course, that's a diachronic question. It tends to be more of a kind of philosophical, even metaphysical question to ask, what is it to be a person in the first place? What is it that makes a hunk of matter, or even a hunk of flesh, a person? Because there are lots of hunks of flesh that aren't persons. There might even be members of our species that are persons. Some philosophers will say, just because you're a member of the species Homo sapiens doesn't mean that you are, synchronically speaking, at this particular time, also a person. It might be that some theories of person, of what it is to be a person, require that you've got, for example, certain psychological capacities, such as the capacity to have self-awareness, metacognition, as some people would put it, that some members of our species don't have, either because they're infants. They're not, somebody might say, they're not people yet. We just hope they're going to be, or because they've got cognitive disabilities of one kind or another. So those are interesting and tough questions, but I tend to think that most people who are interested in personal identity, who are not professional philosophers, are more interested in the more diachronic issues. And that includes such things as, can we make sense of the idea that even though I've gone through all these changes, maybe I used to smoke, maybe I used to do drugs, maybe I have had a lot of different relationships over my life and so forth, different jobs. Could it make sense of the idea that I'm the same person here now as I was 20 years ago back in college or whatever it was? And there are philosophers who can say, who want to say, yes, and let me tell you what that means. The challenge is, it's not quite true. It's an urban legend, it turns out, that when people say we replace all of our cells, every single cell in your body is lost and replaced over a period of 7 or 8 or 10 years. It isn't quite true. There's some cells that seem to last through your entire lifetime. But even if it were true, there's reason to think that you could still persist as a person over time. So that I can say, literally, it's that was me, this very self, that was the one who, for example, when I was 5 years old, my brother dropped a bowling ball on my foot. And I remember that. And it seems that I'd want to be able to say, that's me. That's the same self. I'm just older, et cetera. There are some philosophical theories that try to say, yes, here's what you mean. Here's why. Here's what makes it the case that you're the same person. Even if, contrary to fact, there isn't a cell in common, you'd still be the same person even if there weren't. So that's just a philosophical discussion that I'm hoping people would find independently interesting, in spite of the fact that you've got challenges to it. I also want to make sense, because I think people find it natural to say things like, you know, now that he's stopped smoking, he's a changed man. Well, yeah, but it's not as if George, who stopped smoking in the year 2015, and he's not smoking anymore, it's not as if George 2015 died and somebody else has come to occupy that body. We don't literally mean it's the same, it's a different person, but we can still, I think, make sense of how it is that there's some radical changes that he's undergone, while still being the same person for legal, moral, philosophical purposes.